Spirit Radio Podcasts. The best of the morning show on Spirit Radio.
Last week was the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Time magazine foreign correspondent David Aikman was nearby at the time in Munich when he heard the news. Here I asked David Aikman to share his memories of the reaction to the news of what was happening in Berlin.
Can I bring you back actually to that foreign affairs conference that you were at in Munich? I mean, it's very interesting that it was a foreign affairs conference in Munich, because, you know, most people seem to think that it really was quite sudden and unexpected. What was the response in the room when people began to realize this Berlin Wall was beginning to open up?
Amazing. It was euphoric. I mean, they just, they couldn't, they had imagined it happening, but it was such a jolt from the blue. It had happened so suddenly that they couldn't actually grasp what had really happened. But then when they started seeing the stirring of demonstrations in Prague and throughout Czechoslovakia, they realized that the whole kit and caboodle was coming down, that communism was basically going to collapse. Because after all, you'd had trainloads of East Germans being allowed to leave the embassy grounds of West German embassies in East European countries. They had been allowed to travel to the West for several months. So Eastern Germany was draining itself of some of its most talented citizens.
Yeah.
And so the whole of the rest of Eastern Europe looked on with amazement and said, my gosh, we want some of that too.
And, you know, I'm trying to kind of almost picture myself back then. I was interrailing very shortly after that, about a month or two later, around, and it seemed like everybody I met on a train had a little piece of the wall in their backpack, you know,
right.
Because that's
it.
What they all did. But I'm, you know, you were right there kind of almost as the thing was happening, and the fact that nobody people imagined it happening, but nobody could say this, they never saw it as being something imminent. So what do you think was the thing that finally made it happen in the end?
Well, I think it was what I would call a tipping point in the moral consciousness of the entire population of Eastern Europe. And it started off really in East Germany, because you had marches in Dresden, and the only place where the demonstrators could gather safely were in churches. And so the churches had comprised a major covering for all of the demonstrations that were happening. And the awareness in Prague that this was a moral revolution was not confined to Václav Havel himself. He wasn't even an acknowledged Christian. Mm. But everybody seemed to sense that this was absolutely the end of something evil. And in fact, Václav Mali, who was another member of the dissident group surrounding Havel, actually led the Lord's Prayer in a public stadium above the city several days after Havel had made that speech, and it had a dramatic effect on the crowd.
Wow. I've never heard any of this before. It's really extraordinary to actually realize just how kind of spiritual the revolution was in some ways when it comes to Czechoslovakia.
It was a moral revolution before it was a political revolution.
Yeah.
The best of the morning show.
Next week marks Bereaved Children's Awareness Week. I talked to Maura Keating from the Irish Childhood Bereavement Network about how children respond to losing a loved one.
Well, you see, children react slightly differently to adults when they lose somebody close to them. I mean, obviously they'll have moments of being intensely upset, in the same way as adults do, but often they then kind of get diverted or distracted by just, you know, carrying on with their day-to-day life. So one minute they might be talking to you saying, I'm desperately, you know, I'm really upset and you're really worried about them. And then 2 minutes later they'll say, but I'm going to play with my friends now.
Yeah, yeah.
They seem fine. And you're a bit thrown by that because you think, well, are they upset or are they not upset? You know, whereas as adults, when we grieve, it just tends to, you know, particularly in the early stages, we just get consumed by it all the time. And, you know, we can't stop thinking about it. And it's not that children stop thinking about it, it's just that they kind of protect themselves by just saying, it's too hard to deal with all the time.
Yeah, they're basically regulating their own feelings by jumping in and out of it for as it pleases them. And you know what? That's not that weird. I mean, if you think of any wake that you've ever been to, there's crying, there's roaring, laughing, there's moments. Of, and you know, I really take that point. I was thinking myself. I have a very particular memory from when I was only about 4 years of age, and my great grandfather had died, or was dying, and I was prevented from seeing him and meeting him. You know, as he was going, and it stuck with me forever. You know, I'm remembering it now as a man in his 50s.
Absolutely.
Because they thought they were protecting me from something, and actually, in a way, they were actually not helping me. They were kind of getting me stuck in a kind of a space of grief.
Yes, you're right, Ronan. I mean, I think in fairness, what we try and do as parents and as adults is protect our children from the pain and hurt.
Yeah.
But the reality is, this is life. We can't, you know, the worst has happened when somebody has died. So we're far better off talking to the children, explaining to them, giving them information in an honest and clear and unambiguous way. That's age appropriate. Obviously, you don't bombard a very young child with loads of information that they can't comprehend, but you give them clear, simple language without all the euphemisms. Like, if you tell a little child, oh, well, your daddy's in a better place now, they hear that often as, oh, was our home not a good place for
exactly,
us? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So you're far better off being honest
and
use the real language and the proper language. Yeah. And children respect and love honesty, and they love the facts. They love to be told. They love to feel like, I've been told this. I know now what's happening. Yeah. So keep them in the loop. Explain to them. And sometimes that means explain to them again and again, because it takes a while for them to process. It's a big deal to understand this properly. So it's not a one-off conversation. It'll be an ongoing conversation.
Yeah, I'm almost feeling from what you're saying is that what we're actually doing is we're teaching people, or these are our little people, and just in the same way as we teach them to do Christmas or we teach them to do birthdays, we also have to teach them how to do grief. We have to teach them
how
to do loss.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because if you know, in an ideal world, we wouldn't want to expose our children to death very young, but the reality is it happens.
Yes.
But what the way you help them deal with that grief when they're young builds their ability and their coping mechanisms for the future deaths that they are inevitably going to face as they grow up and mature into adulthood. We all, it's a cycle of life. We're all going to face death and dying, and we have to, you know, learn how to cope with that in a an effective way that doesn't get us stuck. And then asking children questions, but encouraging them to ask questions, letting them know that it's okay to talk, that you're there to talk about it. And even if you don't have all the answers or all the right words, it's okay to say anything they want to say.
Yeah.
And then that reassurance, constantly reassuring them. And the other thing that adults often do, especially if they're the ones who, you know, if it's they're grieving themselves, is they kind of neglect themselves sometimes. And you know, if the adult gets support, whatever way that support comes, whether it's from family and friends, from the local community, whatever way they get their support, that helps them deal with their own grief. And in dealing with their own grief, they become stronger and more able to deal with their children's grief. You know, getting support for yourself and helping and calling in the other adults that are in the children's lives, like whether it's the teacher or the football coach, and getting them to help reinforce the message. So whatever way you, whatever little narrative you've used or whatever way you've described what has happened, share that with the other adults and say, this is what I've said. So if they ask you any questions, you know, these are the words I've used, it might help you. Because often we're afraid to start the conversation because we're afraid to use the wrong words. But still, as I said, honesty, clear, simple information is what children are looking for and will help them.
I'm wondering too, you know, the way we can be a little bit binary about this, as in, you know, I must keep it together if they're going to fall apart, instead of recognising that actually to be grieving together isn't necessarily, everybody's a little bit falling apart, but everybody's a little bit keeping it together at the same time, so that you don't kind of put your own grief on hold in order, because actually you're not really teaching them how to grieve then, all you're doing is just showing them how to shut down, I suppose.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other thing that happens, particularly with slightly older children, is that if they see the adults struggling and not being able to talk to them and not including them in it, they feel like they have to kind of step up a little bit and be the strong one.
Yeah.
And then when they say the adult is, you know, maybe more able to sort of go back to a normal routine, young children often feel, and older children often feel, I can't, I can't now talk to them about my concerns because I'll set them back.
Exactly.
So often children protect adults.
Yeah, very good.
And, you know, in a way, it's about, as you said rightly, it's about sharing the burden together and protecting each other at different times and recognising that we'll all have ups and downs and we'll all have moments of where we're strong and moments where we're a basket case, and that's normal. And we're there for each other in that and helping each other know and have good days and bad days, and, you know, they'll come and go. And we'll all deal with it differently.
Yeah.
Even children, same children, in our children from the same family, different personality, different relationship with the person who died, will have a different response and reaction.
The Best of the Morning Show.
Sometimes we notice people's generosity most when we are travelling, because we're outside of our comfort zone and we rely that bit more on other people's help and courtesy. That's what Des Curtis, pastor at St. Mark's in Ballybrack in South Dublin, found during a recent visit to the United States, which led him nicely into his prayer coach topic, generosity.
The generosity, I suppose, that we experienced over in Oklahoma and up in Chicago was just mind-blowing. And so it was a conversation myself and my wife were having over the last number of days, and just this idea of what does it look like to live a generous life, do you know that way?
Yeah.
And so that's what's coming.
Yeah, like extraordinary generosity. And like yourself, would have done a fair bit of travelling in the US and always blown away by how incredibly generous and hospitable those people are. So, you know,
they're fantastic.
Amazing. So, do you think we have a natural tendency to be generous, or do you think that generosity, you know, is difficult for us?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think some people, it does seem, doesn't it, that some people have that natural tendency to be generous, but maybe they've chosen over time to start being generous, to start having an openness. Maybe they've had, I don't know, great parents or a great family, or they've had really good input around them, showing them, teaching them what living a generous life is like. And then there's people who you're just, they wouldn't give you a jelly out of their bag of jellies. You know, like you're just like, so there's it's a mixture, isn't it?
Yeah,
stuff.
It's true, because isn't it, there's something in our kind of, I suppose, our coping mechanism for the world that we feel like we're losing something.
Exactly.
And to be able to override that and go, no, this is something that's really, not only will it benefit you, but I'll feel better as well. And it takes something extra to
do
that, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, like, when I was thinking about generosity, I was thinking it's the opposite of greediness.
Yes.
And I think when we're naturally greedy, it's like there's a cake and it's like, well, I better get my slice of the cake and stuff everyone else. But generous people always go, well, Ron, no, you have a slice of cake, and you.
Yeah.
And there always seems to be more cake to go around for generous people.
Yeah.
And there's this idea, and it's just even the thought of, like, just even the teachings of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, when he, I mean, encouraged that anyone who listened, it wasn't just the disciples, it was over 5,000 listening, and said, listen, if someone asks you to go a mile, go the extra mile. If someone asks you for a coat, give them two coats. And it's this, and I don't even think it's a momentary thing. It's, I'm just being challenged. I suppose over the last few weeks, I've been both blessed and challenged by generosity. And it's this idea of, well, what does it mean to live generously? Not just to be generous in a given moment.
Yeah, exactly. To have almost like a kind of a philosophy of generosity. That's,
exactly. That's not even about money. It's not.
Yeah.
It's about your time, your gifts.
Yeah.
Some people just have this openness in their lives, and they're open.
Exactly. I like the way you pick that, kind of to go the extra mile as a word. It's completely in the language now. People even forget that where it's from. But the idea that actually it takes energy, time, effort to go an extra mile with somebody. It absolutely has to be done from a spirit of generosity, doesn't it?
No, absolutely. But I think, do you know what, when you go the extra mile, and for people who do go the extra mile, they seem to be able to go the extra mile easier and easier and easier. And it's nearly like, there's some people I know, Ronan, and they live extra mile people.
Yeah.
It's, do you know what I mean? Because it's just part of their DNA. It's part of who they are. As I said, they're just a generous people, and they're open. They have an open home policy. They have an open, their time. They seem to have more time for you.
Yeah.
They're generous with their words of encouragement. Do you know what I mean? Like, how often are we generous with just saying something nice to someone.
Absolutely. And we want to be like that.
Yeah, that's it. That's the challenge. Yeah, and it's a great challenge. And I think even coming up to Christmas, which is, I mean, we're going to be celebrating the greatest gift ever, but let's be honest, it's so commercial. And I mean, we all get caught up in it. And I'm I'm Mr. Christmas. I'm the biggest. it's even a great time to be reflecting on what it means to be generous.
Yeah. So just picking up on that thing that you said earlier on, maybe some people have learned over years and have learned, how do you think we can get better at generosity by practicing it? I mean, how do, it's like almost like creating, would you call it like a habit of generosity or something?
Yeah, yeah.
How would you go about that?
Don't overthink it.
Yeah.
Do you know the way? Like, don't, and here's the thing, being generous, don't be feeling guilty. Irish people were great at doing the guilt.
Yeah, yeah,
oh,
exactly.
Oh, I'm not
yeah.
generous enough. Or,
yeah, yeah, doing it because you feel guilty.
I should
guilty.
Go the extra.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Don't know. Again, the scripture says God loves a cheerful giver. Let's be happy as we're being generous. And it's simple things towards your neighbour.
Yeah.
At least your next door neighbour or work colleague in work. Do you want I'm going down to the coffee dock. Do you want a coffee?
Yeah.
It's simple things that the more you do them, I think the more you are creating in you a culture of generosity. Generally, rather than just going, I'm going to the coffee dock, stuff you, Ronan. You can go get your own coffee.
Yeah.
Ronan, do you want a cup of coffee? I'm going to the coffee dock. And it's just this.
Yeah, it creates a kind of a vibe. I was even thinking about when you're talking about the Sermon on the Mount, and I was thinking, you know, when you think of something like, you know, the loaves and the fishes, and the loaves and the fishes story is based on this kind of act of almost just utterly spontaneous generosity. And I always think it's interesting that it's a boy. You know, as a little fella, you know, and the little fella, he doesn't think, he just does, you know. And I was thinking to myself, I wonder if we were able to catch that moment just before we second think ourselves. Like, it's almost the overthinking that stops you being generous, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, because if you're full of God and you just go, actually, your inclination a lot of the time is like, hey, let's just do this before you get a moment. Wait a minute.
That's my lunch.
That's
my lunch.
Half of my fish are gone, man. I seem to be two fish down on this. on this arrangement.
Absolutely. Step out in that moment of just being generous with your time and with your lunch.
The Best of the Morning Show on Spirit Radio.
There's a conference kicking off in Kilkenny this morning. It's hosted by Doctors for Life and it's addressing the theme, the case against euthanasia. Here's GP, Dr. Ronan Cleary of Doctors for Life.
So euthanasia and assisted suicide, which is legal in many European countries, but not yet legal in Ireland or in the UK, is effectively the intervention by healthcare professionals to preemptively end a life for a myriad of number of reasons, whereas Doctors for Life would see that is actually anathema to us, whereas we see the importance of being doctors as to care for life at all its stages, no matter its subjective worth in the eyes of many people.
Yeah, I was just thinking about this, Ronald, because I was thinking, you know, really, the entirety of your training, you know, and the philosophy that you grow up through and all of the rest is all about preserving life and maintaining life and, you know, and helping people to survive things that otherwise would take their life. And suddenly this idea that you would be taking life, it seems very, very, I suppose, counterintuitive for somebody who has been trained as a doctor.
No, well, for me, it goes against every fibre of my being. I became a doctor because I wanted to help preserve life. I wanted to care for the vulnerable. As many people do in society, not just doctors, there's healthcare professionals, there's nurses, there's public health nurses, there's many people who are outside of the medical profession who care for their loved ones and relatives at every single stage of their life, and for many hours and with many emotions, and don't get paid for it at all. But I suppose what I had the opportunity to go into medicine and to study for medicine, and that inner thought is what binds me to the greater good of what is intrinsically valuable, and there's life itself. People nowadays sometimes do not hold the sanctity of life with as much respect as we may wish. But I suppose Doctors for Life is trying to bring and sort of coalesce the thought and the case against euthanasia and try and combat the idea that it is somehow compassionate or somehow beneficial to society, whereas in fact it's not, because in Doctors for Life, we believe that no matter the subjective view on that person or individual's life, all life is important, and that life itself is worth preserving, and that the doctor's job, his very first role, should be to preserve that life.
Do you think that as countries experience increased pressure on their health services, you know, with aging populations, that there might be a kind of a slow creep, you know, where there's kind of increasing calls for laws about allowing euthanasia because they've more older people or something?
Well, that could happen. That, of course, it would never be an official policy, but it could happen even in people's thoughts or the narrative or the outlook on life.
Sure.
Because once you cheapen life and once you bring a euthanasia and you bring assisted suicide into a country and you try to normalize it, it becomes normal and it becomes very difficult to question. That is what the current government and the ICGB have attempted to do with abortion. They've tried to normalize it, whereas in fact we know that it is not normal, it is simply the killing of an unborn child. So I think Judge Carney, actually, there was a Marie Fleming case there a number of years ago, and he effectively summed it up quite succinctly when he said, in opposing euthanasia, he said, and I'll just quote him, he said, even with the most rigorous system of legislative checks and safeguards, it would be impossible to ensure the aged, disabled, the poor, the unwanted, the rejected, the lonely, and the impulsive, the financially compromised and emotionally vulnerable would not avail of this option in order to avoid a sense of being a burden on their family and society.
Exactly.
Now, that is something that we have to avoid at all costs in this country.
Absolutely.
It is very, very important that we do so. And we cannot accept that euthanasia and assisted suicide is a normal practice of medicine, notwithstanding all the difficult cases that are out there. If we do open it up and legislate for it, this is the risk that is very, very real that this could happen.
Yeah,
And Judge Carney spotted it many, many years ago in the Marie Fleming High Court case.
Yeah.
And it was very, very, very intuitive of him. And I think that the whole point of our Doctors for Life conference, again, I'll just plug it again, it's on Saturday, November the 16th at 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the Lyra Hotel in Kilkenny. And it's €50 for non-medics. And I would encourage people listening to this program to maybe considering attending. There's a number of very good speakers coming over from England and homegrown speakers that are going to support the case against euthanasia.
Tell us who's speaking.
So a young gentleman, a surgeon from the UK, Dr. Callum Miller. You may have seen him on the TV. He's a pro-life doctor from the UK. He's speaking on how did we get to where we are at, an overview of the euthanasia movement. That's the first speech, or the first talk. There's a Dr. Patrick Policino from the Liverpool Care Pathway. There's another young chap, a medical student, David O'Donnell. He's actually got a very interesting speech, a very interesting talk, Surviving the Shark Tank as a Pro-Life Student. Dr. Pada Tobin, actually, from AIM2, will be talking about the future of pro-life politics in Ireland. Because AIM2 is one of the few parties, as you know, who have come out as very much being a pro-life movement, and that is from conception to natural death. And Dr. We're lucky to have Pada Tobin giving a talk there on the future of pro-life politics in Ireland, because effectively the only way that we will turn this around is to have pro-life TDs.
The Best of the Morning Show.
Detective fiction has been a hugely popular and enduring genre ever since its golden age in the years after World War I. I talked to writer and blogger Rachel Sherlock about the great detective writers from that period. Among others, she talked about G.K. Chesterton, the creator of Father Brown, but first, the great Arthur Conan Doyle, creator of Sherlock Holmes. I asked Rachel if some aspects of Doyle's writings were based on a Christian worldview.
Yes, so he was raised Catholic, and he was raised with a lot of different influences, but Catholicism was a very strong one, particularly through his mother and through his education. He had a Jesuit education, and he did lose his faith, but in a way that it was still a very important part of his life. He was very devastated to feel like he had lost his faith. And so religion always played a big part in his life. He really went into spiritualism, if anyone knows. Yes. the later years of Arthur Conan Doyle, he did a lot with fairy hoax and things like that.
Not the healthiest of stuff to be getting into, for
not
sure.
Really, no.
But things like awareness of evil and that kind of stuff would have been very, very big with him in that case.
I think so, and I think there's elements even in, if you look at his Jesuit education, there's that real emphasis on striving for excellence, and I think you can really see that with Sherlock Holmes, and even that element of kind of discernment, that like to see clearly and to be very aware and to, and as you said, recognize evil and do battle with it. I think that I really think that has an influence on Sherlock Holmes as a character.
Do you have any feelings on why Sherlock Holmes was such a popular character, so successful?
Gosh, I mean, I think he's just, I think a lot of it actually has to do with Watson. It's that feeling of like being in Watson's shoes and looking at this very inspiring person and have that person reciprocate admiration.
Yeah.
That like the two of them are in it together. And when you're reading it, you feel like you're in that adventure with them.
I think it's a very, very, that's a very good point, is that we are Watson.
Yes.
And we kind of travel with him. I was thinking too how interesting it was that Arthur Conan Doyle actually did know a medic who was very like Sherlock Holmes, so he was Watson, so he felt like Watson in that guise, and he really wrote Sherlock Holmes really in terms of, you know, the kind of the personality of this particular doctor. It was extraordinary. After Sherlock Holmes, you think everyone started to imitate Arthur Conan Doyle and went writing detective fiction, and this irritated a certain critic, is that right?
Yes, well, I don't think there's endless,
you know it.
an endless pile of Sherlock Holmes pastiches that you can go through, and every newspaper had to have their own Sherlock Holmes at that point. And this was much to the irritation of G.K. Chesterton, who was an enormous fan of detective fiction. He used to just stuff the stories into his pockets before going on the train by the hundreds. Yeah. Like he would just go through them. But he used to get really annoyed at all of these. Yeah. He loved Sherlock Holmes, but all of these kind of copycats, and they all followed the same formula, which was to be sort of this like otherworldly, mechanical, materialistic thing. But because they weren't Sherlock Holmes, they had to get more and more ludicrous. And he said that he was always very disappointed that in these kinds of stories, the last page was always the worst page when it should be the best.
Very good, actually. Yeah. And of course, G.K. Chesterton was well capable of writing some detective fiction himself.
Yes, well then I think in some ways he kind of turned to it to make his own stamp on it. He wrote a very famous series called with a character called Father Brown, who obviously in kind of complete contrast to Sherlock Holmes is a priest detective as opposed to a professional detective. And I love those stories. I think they're great. They really focus on knowing a person rather than knowing the clues. Like he always says that he said that the big problem with those kinds of stories was that they tried to see a person from the outside as if it was an insect that you didn't understand and you were trying to gather clues from, but really the best way to solve a mystery is to know the person as a complete person.
You're absolutely right. There's a kind of a warmth in the Father Brown stories that you don't get in Sherlock Holmes. There's a kind of a coldness in the Sherlock Holmes stories because it's about fact, you know. Whereas you get the feeling from the Father Brown stories, you write down to the very, like there's nothing that gives Father Brown more joy than seeing somebody repent of their sin.
Well, I think that's it. That's the whole point, is that the reason he solves mysteries is not for the chase, and it's not for justice or the law or anything like that. He does it because he wants to find people and help them repent. He's doing it. His detection work is almost like a part of his priestly duties.
And you know, if we may race forward for a moment, and I do want to get pick a you know it up back there again, but you know, this recent number of series that have been done, I think, by the BBC, of Father Brown, they've attempted to keep that particular element in it. Now, I think some of it's very pastiche myself, and I sometimes find it a little irritating, but they do try to keep that bit alive, don't they?
I quite enjoy the series. I really think Mark Williams, who plays
Father Brown, he's superb.
I can watch him do Father Brown all day.
But it's
impressive that they kind of keep it to the fore. I think I don't want to skip ahead, but I've also discussed with my friends about how I think it's the ITV who did the Poirot series.
Yes, absolutely.
But they made a deliberate choice to even make his Catholicism even more present than it necessarily is in the book. So it's interesting that modern filmmakers and TV producers are choosing to keep these religious elements in their detective stories.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes, fascinating. Must come back to that. So, will you tell us about the Chesterton's early book? This was your favourite, I believe.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So this is The Club of Queer Trades, I believe.
Yes.
So tell me all about this, because this is a book I do not know at all. Is it a Father Brown book?
It's not a Father Brown book.
Okay.
It predates Father Brown.
Okay.
It's not a very well known book. It's got a title that most people would be a bit confused with these days. But
of course, it had a different meaning, of course, at the time. Yeah.
But it's honestly one of the funniest and most clever books that I read. It's a series of short stories, but it has two characters that appear in all of them, two brothers. And essentially in every instance, the two brothers happen upon a circumstance which looks very suspect. And one brother, who's a big Sherlock Holmes fan, thinks it's got to be a crime, something nefarious is up. It's, you know, we have to get to the bottom of this mystery.
Yeah.
And in every case, the brother kind of shows, actually, this isn't what it looks like, and maybe there isn't even a crime to investigate, and you're just seeing it through this particular light. And the kind of thread that runs through it is this Club of Queer Trades, which is that the idea behind it is to be in the Club of Queer Trades, you have to have invented a profession that nobody else in the world has ever done.
Okay.
So these characters that are all in this club keep cropping up, and it's very funny.
The Best of the Morning Show.
People are quick to look at world events and define them in terms of contrasts, rich versus poor, west versus east, left versus right. But veteran Irish journalist and author John Waters defines it differently and spoke about this insight at a lecture he gave recently at the University of Notre Dame in the United States. Here's John Waters.
What I said in Notre Dame was that essentially there's a new cleaving in the world, a new separation. And it's not, even though superficially you might read it as, in what is called culture Marxist terms, you would see it as maybe blacks versus whites, it's a racial thing, or it's a gender thing, male versus female, or LGBT versus straight, and all this stuff. It's actually more profound and more interesting. Because fundamentally what it is a separation between the concrete world and the virtual world. And by that I mean that people who make and fix things, people who build the world every day, who clean the world, who bake cakes, who wash windows, who make furniture, who, you know, fix pipes, who make electrical circuits work, the people who work with their hands are actually beginning to wake up to a transformation in the world that is actually very interesting. Like when I was a kid, when I was young, I worked as a clerk in CIE in Claremorris in Westport and Galway, and that was kind of a respectable enough thing. But I always felt that I was never really producing anything, that I was just shoving pieces of paper around. Now maybe you say that was an essential thing, part of the whole thing.
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah,
and it was a kind of a thing.
Yeah,
Camille Paglia once said, I'll give you part of the quote because the other part is slightly more controversial, but she said that every time I cross a bridge, I pay tribute to the genius of men. Mm. And you know, I've often had a related feeling, which is something like this, that every time I cross a bridge, I feel ashamed that I didn't build this bridge or any bridge.
Yeah.
Now, what we actually have in the old days, that, if you like, the pen pushers, and that could be anything from a clerk to a philosopher, shall we say, fitted into the concrete world in a certain way. I mean, like Patrick Kavanagh was a poet, but he was regarded by the working people as one of them.
Yeah.
Now you have a new thing because of bureaucracy, expanding states, big tech, online stuff, all this, whereby there's a breaking away by these people who are forming into new aristocracies. And they're actually now acting as if they are the productive aspect elements of society. You see? And they're looking with contempt at the people who make and fix the world.
Yeah.
And this is essentially what Brexit is about, and it's essentially what Trump is about. Because if you look at what's happened in the last 3.5 years, in both cases, you have essentially these coalitions of aristocracies in America and the United States trying to defy the wishes of the people, which is to say the working people of both of those countries. And they're the same category of people who voted for Trump as voted for Brexit.
Sure.
And the same people who you see on the streets of Paris every day for the every weekend for the last year with yellow vests on, the gilets jaunes. They're the people who are saying, we exist. We have a right to live. You see, and this is essentially, myself and Rita, my wife, we were in New York a few times recently, and we walking around, and a couple of years ago we came across this place called Italy, which is on the junction between Broadway and Fifth Avenue, very close to the Flatiron building. And we go in there, it's like a huge market of Italian food. Like there's stalls and all kinds of vegetables, everything, pasta, you name it. And then scattered throughout it are little restaurants and cafes. And, you know, it's a nice place to be. I'm not a huge foodie, but it's a nice, interesting place to be. There's a nice vibe in it. And coming out the first time, I said, this is a great place. I said, but I'll tell you one thing. I said to Rita, not once since this place opened has there been a Trump voter across the threshold of this place. But if you go out the road 30 miles and you stop at a diner and you go in there and you see Trump's people, they're the guys with the greasy overalls.
Absolutely.
Now, this is the difference. This is what's happening to the world. And we have to decide whose side we're on. I'm on the side of the people like my father who worked.
And who made stuff.
Who makes stuff.
Yeah.
Build stuff.
I understand
that. That's really economic. You see, and people say, well, you know, economics has changed. And no, this is the knowledge economy. But how is that sustained? It's sustained by debt.
Yeah.
That's where all the debt comes from. When you start denying, you see, I keep telling people, when I was a kid, my grandmother had a farm and she had cattle and sheep and chickens. And she produced her own eggs, she produced her own bread, she made her own butter, she had milk, obviously, and she had jam, you name it. Mm. On a Saturday night, the travelling shop came from Brady's in Elphin. She lived in Cluny Quinn, County Roscommon. And she brought down to the gate two trays of eggs, and she exchanged them for tea and sugar.
Yeah.
That was an economy.
Real,
that
yeah.
That is
yeah.
an economy.
I know.
Yeah. And any economy which... with claiming that anything claiming the name of economy that doesn't obey those rules is heading for disaster.
You're absolutely right. I remember Alan Robinson saying many decades ago, I remember hearing him say, you know, where does wealth reside? Wealth resides with people who make stuff.
Yes.
And I remember at least a half dozen times over the years I've gone, is that still true? Is that still true? And you know, it is, because effectively, you know, what became the what do you call it, the factory for the world was China.
Yeah.
And you know, and they were, you know, they were making stuff, and look at them, you know.
Well, that's right. And that's one of the things that has caused the Trump phenomenon, is that he is determined to claw back a lot of the activity that was offloaded to China, the economic activity, which stripped middle America of its livelihood, essentially. And so now you see, you can see symptoms of all this. This is, I call this the peel pretending to be the fruit. You know, because these are the people who claim that the people in there in Italy, you know, with their laptops, they claim to be the thing that makes America great. Yeah. Well, it isn't them. It isn't them. It's the other guys out in the diner.
The Best of the Morning Show on Spirit Radio. Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.